This is William Lucas, tape number two, side number one, taking place on June 20th, 1994 at his home at 260 Prospect Street in Ishpeming, and my name is Mary Andes. At the end of the first tape, we were talking about final recollections on the Lloyd Mine, and you were talking about how hot it was, and that was the place you had described that also was not ventilated and smelled bad and headaches and so forth.
Yeah. It was really hot because the places were real low, and they had a caving system there. They call it, slicing contracts, they called. And the places were real low, and there were always continuous pressure from up over because the ground was just and heavy. And I worked with one miner who had just gone in maybe about 30 feet. And we didn't get through drilling. And he said, we'll go and have lunch, you know. So we come back and we didn't even have time to shut the air off when we just got our dinner pail ready and opened up, all of a sudden the whole top, the back come down, whoosh, just like that. My partner, he didn't say anything. He said, that's enough. Imagine, if we had been in there maybe one minute longer, we'd have been under it. There was no warning at all. It is a new place, it's all covered, but the weight was so great and so high and so large, it come down and it flattened everything down. You know what he did? He grabbed his dinner pail and he went up. He never came back. Sure. Well, there I was, all alone again. And I had a light there, you know. And the boss came through, and he already knew that my partner had gone up. So he said, the place come down. I said, yep, it's flat. He said, well, he said, Billy, he said, you come with me, and I'll put you in someplace else. And I don't know, it didn't faze me much, but it fazed that other guy, my partner. And he never did come underground anymore. He's from Gwynn. He said, that's close enough. Imagine, just by, well, we walked like from that window, that picture window, up to here.
So and that's maybe 15 or 20 feet?
Yeah, well, say about 30 feet, because we were in there about 5 cuts, and they were just going to turn the air off, and I already had my lunch pail in my hand. We're going to find a good place to eat, and boy, geez, that was something.
I want to ask you.
And another humorous part, mix some of that in there. One day then I was working another contract, and I came down on a level, and there was an Italian fellow, old Italian fellow. He wasn't mining, but he was a timber hoister, and he always stayed on a level. And his job was to hoist lagging and poles up the rays to the miners up over. And he was just hoisting what he called some lagging. He had a big coil of it there, say about maybe a dozen, two dozen sticks in a bundle. But there happened to be loose coil. He didn't see it. There was a loose coil inside, and when his partner started to tug it up on top, he thought everything was okay. So he, what do you call it? Starts up, and the tuggers, you know, they start off with a jerk. He grabbed him. The rope was around his leg, and he was on top of the lagging pile. It would zoop up there. I'll tell you. And then when he got to the top, that other Italian fellow was up there. He looked, Tony. And that's when he said, I heard two Italians facing. Oh, did they go to it?
In Italian or English?
Lucky he didn't get his leg cut off. Sure. Yeah, imagine.
Wow.
They pulled him. It's a miracle that he survived. That he was on the other side. He didn't go on the lagging side. He went on a travel road side that it was more open. And he rode the thing way up.
How many feet up did he go?
He was up there about 40 feet.
Sure. Pulled up by the leg.
Yeah, yeah. His leg was caught in a rope.
Was he hurt at all?
He got bruised up, all right, but it didn't cut it. Yeah.
Well, were these guys going at it in Italian or English?
It was all Italian. It was a good thing I didn't understand what he was saying.
Great story. I wanna back up and ask you to define some terms for me again now. You said in the Lloyd mine they used a caving system. What's a caving system?
No, they used a slicing.
Oh, a slicing system? Okay.
Yeah. And mostly slicing. They go, they'd slice, they say the breast was pretty wide, you know, here. They'd go in here, start from one side. Mm-hmm. Then when they get as far as they're allowed to go, then they'd come back and they'd move over another 8 feet. Mm-hmm. And they keep fanning it out just like a wagon wheel spokes. Mm-hmm. Just spokes like this here.
And they were cutting or blasting?
They'd cut, drill and blast. They'd go in about 40 feet. And when they were all through, they pulled out. And they start again the other way. In the meantime, their old workings, they were caving in. And, settling and that, you know.
So if you were looking at the breast, to do these fan-shaped slices, would the dynamite be set then in vertical rows?
Yeah,
and then
you drill a pattern.
Okay.
You had to drill a pattern. You drill maybe about 15 holes. You drill each hole about 6 feet long. Say four in the top and four down below and then down the helper and the sides. So you cut out a block just like between these two doors here. A bunch of holes on the sides and the bottom, center and the top. And when you charge them with dynamite, when you lift the fuse, you always start lighting the ones that would go off first. See, you paused, you know, maybe a few seconds. So they go off in patterns. They wouldn't all go at one time. See, they had to be spaced. Yeah. And
so that blasting technique then is that what a slicing contract
worked? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now when you were describing the caving incident where your partner left when it was all over, you said you had to shut the air off. This was some kind of a hydraulic piece of equipment you were using.
They were all run by air, you know, air drills. And that's at the Mather B, that's where you had caving system, long hole drilling. And you'd drill holes 40, 50, 60 feet long, a pattern right across, and then you charge them.
So this incident when the Lloyd, then you had to shut the air off on the hydraulic drill.
Yeah.
And then you said during that incident the back came down. What is the back?
The roof over your head.
Okay. Reinforced with timber or just plain?
That's that. They're timbered, but sometimes the force is so heavy that it'll break the timber. It just crushed them, you know. Yeah.
All right, now, I think we're just about finished with talking about the Greenwood mine and the Lloyd mine. I would like to talk a little bit more about a couple of things with those two mines. Was there a dry at the Greenwood and the Lloyd?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it was a separate building then from...
Yes. Mm-hmm. At Greenwood, they had a good dry. That's one thing. Yeah, they had a good good surface dry. Your clothes is always nice and dry and heated. And the Lloyd had a good dry. Yeah, they had a full-time dry man. And we had old Angelo Vogel. He was a dry man. I remember one day I was outside, his afternoon shift, and we had a water tap outside. We went there to fill up our canteens and we'll take underground. Angelo Bosley saw a frog down in that green frog in the little spillway there. He reached down, grabbed the frog, put it under the water tap, down the hatch it went. Oh, he said, that's good. He went down alive. Yeah.
We'll continue now with a little more serious subject, and that is the question of membership in a union. Did you have to be a member of a union to work in any of the mines?
Yeah, I was a member of the union, and they really improved the things, a lot of things.
Specifically,
we got our good pensions, and we got our retirements, which we never had before.
Medicare.
I mean, and although it was costly, and strikes, they really cost a lot of money. The first one.
If you were involved or more than one strike happened during the time that you worked, when did the first strike happen while you were working underground? What year would that be? Approximately.
We had just got married. We haven't, 46, I think it was. I think it was 46. That was a long one. I started in the wintertime, and that didn't settle until the following fall. That was hard because you used up all few dollars what you had set aside, and boy, then they wanted you to be on the picket line. I went for a few times, but then I think we were up north for quite a bit, weren't we, Cree?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like being on the picket line, and what season of the year would that have been?
In the summertime, yeah.
What kinds of relationships did the guys have on the picket line? Was everyone pretty committed to the strike, or was there some disagreement?
It was, I don't know. They had different thoughts about it, you know. Mm-hmm. They were just hoping that it would be over, you know, so they wouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And
are there any particular incidents that may have happened during that strike of 46 that stand out in your mind?
Well, not that I know of. I didn't take in on any of their meetings, I didn't go to the picket lines too many times. I think about maybe 3-4 times, then I quit going.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of any disruptions in the neighborhood or anything like that in your neighborhood that might have happened during that time?
Well, around here, not that I know of. I never knew of any. I know there was shooting over at one house over there, but some cars were banged up and that, but mm-hmm. otherwise... I think there was more activity downtown than there was here.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell me a little bit more about the shooting? What precipitated it, and was anyone injured, or was it?
No, this guy, he came out of his house and he fired two 22 rifle shots at the guys, but he didn't shoot at the guys. He just scared them off or something, you know.
Why did he do that?
Well, they were hollering and protesting outside his house and calling them names and that, and then he went back inside. Yeah.
Was that because he was opposed to the strike?
He was opposed, yes.
Mm-hmm. Were there any consequences for him? Was there any police action? Was he ever arrested or anything like that?
No,
or was that?
No, he was. There was no charges filed.
You said there were some things that happened in town, like in, I presume that's in the downtown Ishpeming area. Do you remember what kinds of things happened during that time? Volatile?
I do know that there was outside agitators came in here. And you'd see them downtown. There'd be 3-4 guys in a group. And they were from Minnesota. And there was one from Ishpeming. They were getting paid $25 a day for inciting the miners around here and down at the taverns, buying them drinks, and get them guys really agitated, you know. And so I heard most of them were outsiders, and from Copper Country, quite a few.
You said the agitators were getting $25 a day. At that time, what would you guess them? What was? Do you remember what your daily wage would have been about that time?
That was way above our scale. We didn't even get a good miner was making only about $8 a day. Imagine. Yeah.
Do you remember there being a lot of tension among people in the community that normally would have been friends as a result of the strike?
Well, I don't know. It made a lot of bad feelings, all right, even in between the relatives and that. And but it's soon forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to digress off of the actual events in the mine for a minute and just ask you, it sounds like this strike would have lasted maybe 9 or 10 months. How did you make ends meet? What did you do for a living during that time when you couldn't work?
Well, I think, did I work cutting pulp? I'm not sure. No. That was after that then. But there was quite a few other strikes then too. Yeah, we had our savings, you know. Yeah.
And that's
what I said, we used up our savings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that by itself is noteworthy because making $8 a day, you were still able to save quite a bit.
Yeah, they were getting $25 a day.
Yeah. All right, so the strike of 1946 would have happened during the time that you were working at Cliff Shaft?
Yeah.
Let's get back to Cliff Shaft a little bit. Having had you worked in the Lloyd mine by then and the Greenwood mine, you mentioned that the cage was particularly a huge technical improvement over the other mines. What other things do you remember at Cliff Shaft that were better than working at the Lloyd or the Greenwood?
In general, the working area,
mm-hmm.
You had fresh air. It wasn't fresh, but it was fresher. It's cold, where you had hot, humid conditions at the Lloyd. Over here, the average temperature was around 48, sometimes colder. Because when we're drilling at Cliff Shaft, our machines sometimes would want to freeze up. We'd have to blow the exhaust on the machine to blow the big slug of ice out of it, you know. And you'd have to have your dress. In the Lloyd mine, you could go to work with almost your t-shirt. It was so hot. Cliff Shaft, you wore heavy mine underwear, a pair of pants, Then your coveralls on top of that. And the same thing, you'd wear a heavy under, you know, heavy wool undershirt. And then a regular shirt and a jacket. Then even you would get cold. And your boots, you'd wear heavy socks with nips there in them.
What's nips?
Them little half socks, you know, that comes up to your ankle. Everybody wore nips in Mace.
How about, we've talked a little bit about the carbide lamps that you had in the other mines. What kind of lighting did you have at Cliff Shaft?
We had, when I went there, they were just introducing the electric lamps at the Cliff Shaft.
And this would have been about what year?
I think around, I'd say 46. Yeah, it was, okay. I went to Cliff Shaft in 1938.
And were you a miner at Cliff Shaft the whole time?
I started off a trammer.
A trammer?
Trammer.
Can you describe what a trammer does?
You start with a pick and shovel. You clean out what the miner had blasted. You'd load that into cars and haul them out, you know, load the train instead of having machinery. In some places, they couldn't get machinery in there. It had to be done by hand, you know.
For what reason couldn't they get machinery in there?
They were... the place was such a way that it was up over high hills and dales in there that they didn't want to put machinery in there because the miner's going to be in there only for maybe a couple of months. And he had to get a hole through some way in there. But
so clarify for me, the floor then of the drift wasn't flat. Was the reason for that?
It was flat, yeah.
But you said it went up and down hills and valleys?
Well, the stokes themselves, you know, were the ladder roads, you know. They went up and down through canyons and whatnot, you know.
Now, was the reason for that the rock was too hard to break it open and make straight passages?
they just mined where the ore was, you know. Okay. Yeah.
So it followed where the vein went?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just make that cold, please.
All right. You said before, while you worked as a trammer with a pick and shovel. And then, about how long did you do that?
Oh, about a year and a half. Then I went mining.
And then did you mine for the entire rest of the time? Was it about 30 years altogether?
I mined and the rest of my duration there.
Now, during the time that you worked in the mine, was working for Cleveland Cliffs or working in mining considered to be about the best job that there was around? For guys that had maybe finished high school or didn't go to college?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. For what reasons?
Well, it was close to home. The money was good at the time. And the work wasn't too bad, you know. They had a lot of machinery there and nice bunch of guys to work with all the time. And in fact, your miner, he was actually his own boss, you know.
In what way?
He prepared the place the way it should be, you know, that what to do and where to drill, and he made sure that it was safe. Mm-hmm. So, and
did you have the impression that people took a lot of pride and really cared a lot about the quality of their work?
Oh, yes. A miner had to take a good pride in his work. He had to. He's the one that had to work under it, because he had to bar the loose, and he had to make sure that there was nothing left up over. And otherwise, if you'd be walking underneath and a piece would fall off, it wouldn't have to be a big piece that would kill him, because that stuff is heavy and sharp. And he made his place safe.
No.
He had to, because we had safety men that would come through quite regular, and they check. Yeah.
I understand that in some of the other mines, like the Mather B particularly, the pay system was such that if you were a miner, you got a basic hourly rate, but you also got a bonus for footage. Was that true in the Cliff Shaft also?
In Cliff Shaft, we got paid what we put out. If we didn't put anything out for the half, say the first 15 days, you still got your basic pay. And the basic pay was company count, we used to call it, you know.
And that was about how much, maybe, like when you started mining, you remember how much that would have been?
Yeah, it was around $5, something like that.
A day?
Yeah.
Okay, so. And then you said the first 15 days you would get company count. What happened if you didn't make your goals on after that?
Well, you would, if you had saved some ore out, they'd give you credit for what you got out anyway. Well, it wouldn't be much anyway, but you had the Cliff Shaft mine, you had to put out 10 cars per shift. Say it was a 10 shift half, you had to put out 100 cars to clear company count, over company count. And anything over company count, then you got contract.
And the contract wage would have been what, and based on what?
Well, they got paid so much a car. That's the way it was. And but that the captain, he could juggle them big books. He paid some of them all timers. They got paid good, even if they didn't have a pound out. I know one guy said, "I get the same all the time. Cappy, he paid me good," he said. Because he was bringing them turnips, beef, pork. Cap Oles didn't, he didn't have to buy anything.
No names. This is tape number two, side number two, of the interview with William Lucas on June 20th, 1994, taking place at his home. Continuing with talking about some under-the-table gifts to the captain, as it were, and there was a situation in the captain's home that you mentioned.
Yes. Well, the old-timers used to make sure that the cap was well-fed. And I assume the cap, he favored those old timers, you know.
Can you relate the incident of the told by the person who worked at the cap's house?
Yeah, she said that when she'd get out, come there early in the morning, she said there'd be these old miners, 5:30 in the morning. They wanted to sneak in there before nobody would see them. And they'd hide out, show the package and say, "Here's Cappy," and he'd say his name, you know. And then he'd go and said, one morning there was three of them. Imagine, pork and beef, potatoes, turnips, What Nazis sending all kinds of stuff? And another thing, you know, the cap, he favored them. He had a camp at Wolf Lake. And he recruited these Wolfins there always on the weekend. He'd drive them up there, but they had to bring their own grub. And he'd get out there and he'd have a work crew for a crew cutting firewood. And then guys would be out there with crosscuts and axes and sledgehammers. They split and piled wood and everything. Then they ate their own grub. Well, it was time to go home. Cap would gather all the grub that them guys had brought with him, and he put them in his own pack sack. He said, you guys don't need that anymore. He put them in his car, you know. And he took all their grub too, and then he said they were coming back from Wolf Lake, and they ran out of gas up by Dexter out here, you know. Yeah, by the big pasta shop out there. And he said, there, we had to push that car all the way from there up to Ishpeming. Imagine those four old bucks pushing that car. It was a touring. I can't remember, was it a four touring or what? But this cap was steering the thing into the four bucks.
But they knew that when it came to company count, Cap was going to take care of them.
Yeah, and because I not one guy, one of them guys, he worked close by me at the mine there, and it was payday. And the boss came around with the list, and they said how much we made, you know, for the half. And I said, geez, I said, I made a dollar, you know. And this old guy said, oh, he says, I get dollar all the time. I get dollar all the time. Imagine. And he wasn't producing any or that half. He was just getting ready and then barring loose. And he was there smug, you know. And that pays.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Any other things about Cliff's Shaft that particularly are memorable? I guess I want to ask a question about the ore at Cliff Shaft. You said it was hard ore?
It was hard blue steel ore. In areas, it was it just so happens that where I worked on fourth level, that area was considered the hardest ore in the mine. And I had the honor of breaking in a lot of machines. Anything new that came in the line of drilling machines, they said, take them into Billy Lucas's place. And I had sometimes four and five machines there trying out. They were coming out with Gardner Denver and Joy and Chicago Pneumatic, Ingersoll Rand. What the mothers? And then they're trying out different bits. They were converting over to carbaloid bits now, detachable bits on rods. And I had salesmen from all them companies trying out their brand of bits. I even had a young engineer from Sweden. There was one machine that we tried out. Yes, it was a Swedish machine. And he was trying what his machine would do in that ground. And he had a machine there that was closely guarded. When he came even there, he had it in a leather suitcase, like, under lock and key. Imagine. And he was there 1 week with me. I got a kick out of it. And when it was dinner time, this young engineer, you know what he had for dinner? A big coconut. Sure. I told you that, Crean. I said, Yeah. He had a great big coconut. He busted it. He said, "That's all you're going to eat." He said, "That's enough."
Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever?
The engineer told me something too, that he was going taking up geology and mining, and he said he had 3 years in technical school in Sweden, but before he can get his diploma and before he can graduate, he has to go out in the world someplace for 1 year in the line of mining. No matter what it is, it's iron ore or coal or silver or lead or copper. You've got to go for 1 year. And he said that's what he's doing. Then he goes back to Sweden. And he said about, he had good drills with them. That Swedish steel, you probably heard about it. Because you couldn't bend it, you know. You couldn't break it. It would just bend over. You would take a long 12-foot pipe, you know, and you'd put it in the hole and drag it right down to the ground. It'd spring right up and just like an arrow, straighten out. It wouldn't bend. Where our steel, you put a pipe in a hole, pull it down, it'd stay there. Big hoop. They had a secret, you know, that was military secret. He says, anybody working in their mills, he said, they're under tight security. And no information. You can't even, it's hard to get in them places even. They check your background and everything. And he said he was in some of the places. He said there's 15, 20 guys working. And he said one guy doesn't know what the other guy is doing. Yeah. They had good bits too, you know. And well, the CCI bought one of their machines, you know. And they bought one of each of the others. And yeah, because that was a delay for me too, because I, for all the time that I was there, they were just taking up a lot of my time. So testing, you know. Mm-hmm. They want to run one bit in there, 1 minute, okay, stop. Pull the machine out. What shape is the bit in? And all that, you know. Then you'd have to record. Well, heck, I wasn't getting any dirt out. I just got company count. They benefited by it. Mm-hmm. Sure. And I told the boss, I said, them guys are benefiting. I said, I got about 2 dozen rods here. I said, they're all in my way. Because when I start drilling, I got to find out where the partner for each one now. They're all different make, you know, and the type of thread and the shanks on them. And, yeah, but they were there, you know, for I'd say all 1 year. Sure.
What in your, is there one of those pieces of drilling equipment that you felt was the best after seeing all of those in operation?
Yes, I do. There was one that was a Chicago Pneumatic. That was a light machine, and it could drill just as fast as any of the others, Ingersoll Rand, you know. The others were heavy. And say 10 pounds more means a lot, especially when you got to keep lifting it up and dragging it around. And then you mount them on the jack leg. You don't have to drill them. You put mounted on that leg, and you have to know how to use that jack leg. That's like a hydraulic in there. And
I need to have you describe what a jack leg looks like.
Jack leg?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the machine it's a tube. It's in two sections. the top section goes down into another tube down below, you know, and the machine is on top, and the hoses are hooked on to the machine and a jack leg. And when you turn your air on, it raises up the tube and the machine comes up same time. Then you can stop at any level, you know, any height, and you got to know how to use them. Because I was the first one to use them. And all kinds of, what do you call it, monkey business.
Mm-hmm. So you were the, what's the word that they say, the you were the market research person for all those.
I sure did. And, I sure did. But it was a big jump, you know, from the previous machines we had. We had the old type machines, they were on a tripod. And that piece of junk was heavy. You needed a man and a boy to pack them around, you know. And then the machines were big water liners. They were about 3 feet long. And they'd slide on a rack, you know. And you'd feed them with a crank, air drilled. And, well, they eliminated all those old-type machines. And lots of the old-time miners at the mine, they resented that when they come out with them jack legs. They were, they had some fun with them, because once you did, if you didn't know how to operate, you turn the leg on, all of a sudden that thing would chop up and it'd lift up in the air sometimes.
So they couldn't keep up with the times then, huh?
They cursed them more than once. Yeah, there was one time there was one Italian fella. He came to work in my place there. He worked on a side there. And who the heck was it? He was getting a scrape, but he needed an eye bolt hole. An eye bolt hole is when they drill a hole into the breast, you know, and they put a piece of steel in there with a wedge and a ring on it. They can put a hook on it and a block. And he had to drill that eye pin hole. And he was all alone there, and he couldn't get that bit started, you know. That machine was, he was pretty green with that machine, you know, and that jack leg. As soon as he turned the air on, it started to go up, 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 and his rod was going up. And he come down, you know, and he fell down. Well, then the boss come through, and I told him, I said, Stag over there is having a hard time getting that eye pin. I said, you better go over there and give him a hand. So he went over there. Bob, what do you call, I won't mention his name, but the boss, he grabbed the machine. He had never been on one. He figured he's going to put it in there. Soon as he put the air on, right away that machine went up, and he went right somersault. And he cursed. He soon had the thing down. He said, Billy, he says, come on over here and put this eye bolt in for this guy. Imagine. The boss couldn't. He had never mind in his life. He was made second captain.
Okay.
Oh, another thing I'll tell you about. About Murphy. You know, they said about over 100 years ago, way up in the upper levels, they said a man was supposed to have disappeared, and they said they actually had seen his ghost up there, you know. And this fella that was putting that eye pin hole in my place, you know, he happened to be up in that territory working. And one day the boss went up there, and he was chosen in his working place. He said, "What's the matter?" He said, I seen him. "What'd you see?" "I seen old Murph." He go on, "Yep." He said, I seen him coming ahead. He come right through that puddle of water, and he said he was coming right at me, and he had one eye. He said, "That's when I took off." Well, he said, "Don't believe that." He says, "I'm not going back." Oh, I said, "You better go." But he says, "If I see him coming again, I'm going to jump down the rails." Well, boss figured, he said, I don't want you to jump down the rails. He said, "Tell you what," he says, "come on with me." So they come down from second level all the way down to fourth level. And boss said, "Billy," he said, I don't mention his name, but he said, he's seen Murph up there. And can you give him something to do out there?" I said, "Yeah. He can start cleaning out. I'm going to drill a place over there. He can scrape out a place." He stayed there then for a couple of months till they found a place for him, said he. But he said, "You got to go down to Billy's place, or Billy will watch after you." "That's going to go down the hole. Jump down the rails about 100 feet. Yeah.
I just have to ask you one question. Yeah. Did anybody ever know whether Murphy only had one eye?
No one ever said anything more about it. Yeah, but they said that's a rumor from over 100 years back. Yeah. The boss came through with, no, there was some mean engineer. He was with the second captain. And the second captain casually told the mean how that fellow over there, he seen Murph up there, you know. Well, some dean turned around and told the second captain, he says, "How do you know he didn't see you? How do you know?" "Sir, that's it." He said, "He could have seen him." He said, "When you imagine long enough to think," he said, "they'll appear." "Sure." And that was the real old workings, you know, where when the mine had first opened up, and places were small and that, you know. Oh, geez. We found a lot of places where miners had worked years and years before. The miners had to pay for everything that they used on the ground. They had to pay for their powder and fuse and hose. Everything was charged on their new bill. Imagine. Yeah.
How do you know that?
Well, I've talked to some of the old timers, you know, and they said that's the way it was, yeah. Because we found a piece of hose, a rubber hose about an inch. There was about a 10-foot piece of it. And what was wrapped around that hose? There were wire and a piece of tin and old rubber and burlap. It was about that thick.
About a foot thick?
Pretty near a foot thick. And I said, I brought that up, and I showed it to with one captain there. And I said, "What do you count for that?" Well, that's when he said the miners had to pay. They had to buy their own hose. That poor guy said he was trying to salvage whatever he could, you know. He said he didn't get very much air out of that hose. Sure. And then we found a big bundle of candles. The one bunch that was like that there, like a bunch of bananas. still tied with a string, and probably the guy hit him there and forgot him, or either got killed or something, who knows, you know. And God, they said the old cell would mine behind the hospital there.
What was the name of that mine?
Cellwood Mine. That's right behind the brownstone shops. You can go from Cliff Shaft Mine into Old Cellwood Mine. And there is something to see in that Old Cellwood Mine. Of course, that's underwater now too, you know.
But you've been there?
Yeah, I've been there. When we used to work, before I went mining, I was working up in there, tramming. And we'd get through our work, what we had to do. We'd tell the boss we're going up in the Cellwood after. Well, he said, you can go, but be careful. And just to explore around. Mm-hmm. They had narrow wooden rails, only about 14 inches apart, and little cars about the size of this here, buckets that they used to shovel in.
And the dimensions of those little cars, can you give me in like feet and inches what those dimensions would be?
Well, I don't know. They
maybe like 3 feet by
two. About maybe 3 feet by 2 feet, them cars. Then the guys, when they load them cars, they had to push them all the way out to a razor. Yeah, there was something.
What else did you see in the Cellwood Mine?
We got into one opening there. You would swear that you was in the cemetery. There was stalagmites, you know. Ice. Some of them were as high as this room. They were so thick, you couldn't hardly squeeze through them. Water dripping down all the time. It was something pretty. That room was about the size of this room.
And the dimensions of this room would be about how big?
I'd say about the size of this room, about 20, say about 30 by 10, something like that. And then the huge timber is holding that place up, you know, the back, you know, the cover overhead. Big square timbers, about 16 inch square, and about, some of them were 20 feet long. One after another, set at an angle to hold the back way up. We often wondered how they ever got them up there. What method did they get? Because they had to go in at an angle. Gee, I'll tell you, that was something. And then there was right where stalagmites were. There was one room set aside, and there was a horse barn there, or cow barn, or not, mule barn. They had mules there too, you know. You could still smell the mule in there. And outside the mule barn, there was a big, big pile of boots, leather boots, and shoes. And the tops were split on every one of them. I said, what the heck was the idea? He said, when a guy broke his leg, he said, they cut the boot off and threw the boot and they sent the man up. He said, there was a guy getting hurt every week.
Do you have any guess on how many boots you saw laying there?
Oh, I'd say it must have been a good dozen or so in that spot. Yeah, maybe more. And they were an old-time shoe, them hobnails. That isn't like they had at Cliff Shaft, some of them old fins. They had boots out of car tire. You know, there was quite a few of them. cut a piece off an old tire and nailed it on to the mining boots. Yeah.
Why would they do that?
So they get more service out of their boot. Boot will last longer. Because a pair of boots at Cliff Shaft wouldn't give me a... You're lucky if you got 8 months. The ore is so sharp, it just tore right into them, you know. And you could wear leather shoes there. They were, although I had rubber boots.
Mm-hmm.
And
would the boots have reinforced toes in them?
Oh yeah, safety toes. Mm-hmm. Everybody has safety toes.
And you had to replace the boots almost every 8 months. What would it cost you for a pair of boots at that time?
At that time, they're around $8, $9, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was. Then we had, when we worked in the shaft there, they had a Canadian boot that they introduced. And that was a stiff boot. There was no... The instep was so stiff you couldn't bend it. You're just like two pipes on your on your feet, you know. That didn't go over so good. Yeah. And
when you would replace boots and things like that, would you get those at a store in town, or was there a place that the company provided that you could buy boots through the company, or how?
We got them all at Lothbridge. That was a general store. Yeah. That's, I don't know who's there now. I think there's a UP tax service there, something like that. Jeans tax service. And, but Lothbridge, he was a general distributor for all mining clothes. If you didn't have the money, put it on the books. That's okay. Pay when you can. He was good.